The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Our new Civics 101 podcast launched on Inauguration Day with the goal of answering one question a week about how our democracy works for the first 100 days of the Trump presidency. Well, guess what? We are just blowing up. The podcast held steady at number 7 on the iTunes charts over the weekend. So clearly a lot of people from all over the country are looking for clarity and for guidelines. Now, there is no specific call for a White House press corps in the Constitution, but freedom of the press is a bedrock of our democracy. And today, Scott Horsley is giving us a guide from the inside. He's NPR's senior White House correspondent. He's been on the beat since 2009, so he knows a thing or two about what goes on in the White House briefing room. I asked him how he envisions his role as White House correspondent.
Well, you're right. There is nothing in the Constitution that says that there ought to be 49 seats in close proximity to the Oval Office for D.C.-based reporters. But right there in the First Amendment, the founders were very much aware of the importance of a free press and the watchdog function that we play. And we see our role as being the eyes and the ears of the American people who can't physically be there and don't have the time to be there in a watchdog role for themselves. So we're there watching for all the people who want to know what the president and his team are up to.
What's a typical day for a member of the White House press corps?
Well, there's no such thing as a typical day. Every day is different, and certainly the opening days of any administration are particularly interesting and volatile. And at some point, that kind of opening frenzy will, we hope, settle down just a little bit. And then it's, you know, there's a rhythm of the president doing kind of public events where he's making a statement, meeting with people on camera, sort of trying to make a point through his persona. Then there are private closed-door meetings, sometimes with lawmakers, sometimes with members of his cabinet, to influence the direction of legislation or influence the direction of regulation. We've seen this president saying he wants to roll back regulations in a big way. We've seen him talk about trade in a way that's maybe at odds with members of his own party on Capitol Hill. So we're still sort of trying to sort out, you know, which of the statements that he made on the campaign trail and which of the statements he's made in the White House are going to prove out.
But you do show up, like your colleagues, every day at the White House press corps briefing?
Well, at NPR, we have, during the Obama administration, we had three of us who covered the White House. We've upped that a little bit to have four of us covering the White House in the Trump administration. So not all of us show up every day. Maybe one of us will be there physically at the White House. Another one might be out in the country somewhere talking to voters. One of us might be back at headquarters monitoring executive orders that the president's put out. So there's a lot to keep an eye on, but one of us is certainly there. Our seat in the press room is not quite front, but center. We're in the second row center seat, so we're not quite a front row seat, but a prominent seat to kind of watch the daily briefing.
So at that daily briefing, what don't we know or see that goes on?
Well, you can see it all. I mean, for better or worse, the daily briefing, at least ever since the Clinton administration, has been on live television. Mike McCurry, the press secretary in the Clinton White House, who allowed that to be a daily televised event, has sometimes said that was his biggest mistake. And there are plenty of us, I think, who would agree, because once they put it on camera, for all the gains in transparency and civic education, it unfortunately sort of turned the daily briefing into less of an exchange of information and more of a kind of a piece of performance art, where you have a lot of the reporters and the press secretary kind of posturing for the TV cameras and the audience on cable news or on C-SPAN. But what you don't know, I guess maybe is, if you don't follow it regularly, maybe just how little actual information is conveyed at those briefings. They run, typically in the Obama era, they ran about an hour, and it was often sort of the least informative hour of my day. I might learn more making phone calls or, you know, reading position papers or talking to people behind the scenes. But what it is an opportunity to get a spokesperson for the president on camera, on tape, saying something.
But that is a criticism about the White House press briefing daily, that there is no real news made there. I'm going to go further with critics saying it's a stenography pool at the White House press corps, passing on whatever talking point the administration is on for the day. They're rarely covering real news. And now presidents have Twitter to get their message out. So what is your case, Scott, for why the White House press corps matters and is necessary?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of a lot going on in that question, as the press secretary himself might say. we do get critiqued for being stenographers. We don't see that as our role. On the other hand, I sometimes get criticism that I don't do enough stenography. And it's interesting. The people who are making those criticisms have changed a lot with the change of party and control of the White House. When Barack Obama was in the White House, there were Democrats who thought I should maybe just pass on more of what the president and his staff said in an unfiltered way and more uncritically, while Republicans would complain that I didn't challenge them more. Now it's just the opposite in terms of the party that's doing the complaining, the party that wants more stenography. But no, our role is not simply to write down what the president or his spokespeople say and then pass it along unfiltered or uncritically. It is to probe and to examine and to also hold it up to other pieces of evidence. You know, if Sean Spicer comes out and says this is the largest crowd to ever witness a presidential inauguration in history, period, it's our duty to say, well, here are some other pieces of information that contradict that, in this case, flatly disprove what the press secretary said. There are lots of cases that are not as black and white as that, where, you know, the administration will argue that XYZ has happened in the economy, and, you know, you might say, well, that is either because of or in spite of or partly because of and partly in spite of some action that the administration's taken. So it is part of our role is to certainly listen to what they have to say, hear them out, but also challenge, probe, and introduce other information, try to provide context, try to provide meaning.
What kind of relationship do you want to have with a White House press secretary? Obviously, you're trying to vet their information that they're putting out there. And as you said, you're there for the American people.
Yes. And the relationship is necessarily adversarial. It's adversarial by design. We're not supposed to just be tools of the White House. But on the other hand, it doesn't have to be ugly. It doesn't have to be hostile. It can be businesslike. We certainly had adversarial relations at times with the Obama administration. I spent part of that time serving on the Correspondents Association, which is sort of the liaison between the working press and the White House. And we certainly had complaints about usually restrictions on, you know, what press access might be to the president or his aides, or, you know, the terms under which information was distributed. We certainly had an adversarial relationship at times, and it's the nature of the job that you're always pushing for more access. The White House staff is always sort of pushing to control their message. It has been somewhat more adversarial in the opening moments of the Trump administration, but we had some encouraging signals during the first formal briefing on Monday that Sean Spicer understands that it's in no one's interest if we're just in open warfare. It doesn't help them to always be openly fighting with the press corps, and it doesn't help us if we can't get information from the White House staff. You mentioned Donald Trump's Twitter feed. As technology has evolved, presidents have had more of an opportunity to spread their message over the heads of or without going through the filter of the White House press corps. That's not absolutely new. You could say that Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats were a way to reach out directly to the American people on the radio without having to go through the newspaper reporters who dominated the press corps at that time. Barack Obama was masterful in circumventing the White House press corps through the use of the White House website, his own video news releases. And so what Donald Trump is doing with Twitter is different in degree, maybe, but it's not different in substance.
All right, I've got a logistical question about the press briefing room. How does the seating work? Does an administration assign correspondents to certain seats or first come, first serve?
For most of the period that there has been a press room, the White House staff has found it to their advantage not to assign the seats in the briefing room, but to let the reporters themselves make that determination of how the seats would be assigned. Early in the Ronald Reagan administration, Larry Speaks did do the seating assignment himself. That was Reagan's press secretary. But Most press secretaries after that have decided it's better to let the reporters themselves decide how to allocate the seats. But if the Trump administration decides to shake that up, they may try to do that. We'll see.
Well, as president-elect, Donald Trump did shoot down Jim Acosta, the CNN reporter. If there are threats of being evicted or being chastised publicly by the president, is that going to have a chilling effect on the kinds of questions that White House correspondents ask in those briefings and in other situations with the press?
Being excluded from a press conference would certainly have a chilling effect. And the White House Correspondents Association has said that we would object strenuously if now President Trump or any of his aides tried to exclude working reporters from either the briefing room or from, you know, presidential press conferences. Being ignored by the president or even being chastised or belittled by the president won't necessarily have a chilling effect on the press corps. We're grown-ups. We have thick skins. We're used to being berated by our by our listeners, by our readers, by the politicians we cover. So the fact that Donald Trump engaged in sort of a shouting match with Jim Acosta of CNN, that was maybe more visible than what we usually see in the decorous presidential press conferences or news conferences by president-elect. But that in itself, I don't think, will have a chilling effect. There have also been questions about, you know, how the rest of the press corps responded when then President-elect Trump refused to take a question from Jim Acosta.
Right. There have calls been for some solidarity. Everyone else should have asked the question, that kind of thing.
Some who have suggested that we all should have asked Jim's question for him. I don't necessarily disagree with that, but as one of my colleagues, Glenn Thrush, formerly of Politico, now of the New York Times, pointed out, Barack Obama always came to a press conference with a list of reporters that he planned to call on, and he generally stuck to that list, and other reporters could jump up and down and raise their hand, and the president didn't call on them. He didn't make a scene of it the way that Donald Trump did in with Jim Acosta, but there was never some expectation that, you know, every reporter had a right to ask his question of the president, or if denied that right, that other reporters then had an obligation to ask that question for him or her. So, you know, it may at times be a useful strategy, and we may occasionally adopt that strategy. But it's always been the case that presidents call on some reporters and don't call on others.
So, Scott, you are not an academic or a civics scholar, but as a practitioner, what is the most important thing that people should know about the role of the White House press corps? The big takeaway.
We are not here to influence the outcome of a debate or to play favorites or to help or hurt the president or his team or members of Congress. We're here to cover the news.
And we are so glad that you are there to do it for us. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
NPR's senior White House correspondent Scott Horsley giving us a primer on the White House Press Corps for episode 2 of Civics 101. You won't miss a single class if you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Google Play by searching for Civics 101. And please take a moment to review the podcast, which makes it easier for other people to find it. Sharing knowledge is a surefire way to ace this class.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the Economist Quality of Death Index for 2015, that's a comprehensive rating of how countries treat their terminally ill, the U.S. ranked 9th out of 80 countries. Not awful, but not great either. While the country has made some great strides in improving palliative and hospice care, one demographic is going largely ignored: kids. Eleanor Cummins is a journalist who focuses on science, and she recently wrote about the specialized considerations required for good pediatric palliative care. The article, called "American Children Deserve a Better Death," appeared in Slate. And Eleanor, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So this is obviously not a subject that any parent or society wants to face. But what is it that makes hospice or palliative care for children different than for the elderly or even other adults?
Children have much more complicated illnesses than adults. So where you can kind of graph or chart the way an adult's illness might progress and provide standard care along the way, a child that is ill is likely going to get better and worse and then worse and then better and then worse again in a kind of really unpredictable pattern. So it makes it really hard to intervene and provide the right care along the way. And it makes it more intensive. Additionally, there are special concerns when it comes to medicating a child. They have much smaller bodies and are also much more sensitive to drugs. So a physician who's prescribing medication for a terminally ill child needs to know the specifics of pediatric dosing. And then there's also the emotional part. A child who is dying is going through a really specific set of kind of feelings and emotions, and so are their parents and siblings. I've spoken with a lot of nurses who have talked about how, you know, when a parent dies, it can be really difficult to deal with, but it is something that you expect. Like, as a child, you know that one day your parents will no longer be there. And usually you're in a position where you're able to kind of help them navigate that end of life situation. But when it's your child, that's never something that you really have to deal with. You don't think about how your child could die. And that creates a situation where parents really struggle to cope and to continue to parent the child that's dying, as well as their siblings who are kind of having to watch this really terrible and rather unprecedented event kind of unfold.
I don't think a lot of people even consider hospice or palliative care for kids. How many children do qualify for hospice care?
You know, the numbers on that have been really hard for me to track down. But it's in the thousands in the United States. And the reason that it's difficult to tell is because the numbers kind of depend on whether you're looking at palliative or hospice care. And then because children go in and out of the system, it's difficult to track them all the way through. But there are sizable numbers. One of the groups that I spoke with, for example, is in Southern California, and they are dealing with about 70 pediatric patients who need a variety of care as they are dealing with what's called complex illnesses that are potentially life-limiting.
Where did the 41,000 number come from in your reporting?
So, according to the CDC, 41,000 children and young adults die each year from a variety of illnesses. And so that number is the comprehensive number, right? That's what happens in the U.S. in a year, and it builds in everything. So with 41,000, you're looking at accidents, which unfortunately kill a lot of children. And those aren't ones, right, where you would need to intervene with palliative or hospice care. But then there are also congenital defects, childhood cancers, and other medical issues that that occur in children. And so those are the situation where pediatricians have the opportunity to intervene and to really help families navigate the kind of situation that they find themselves in with a really sick kid who ultimately may never get to grow up. And so that's the kind of subset of that number that we're looking at with the pediatric palliative care population.
Well, knowing when it's time to transition to hospice care is not a clear or easy choice for most adults. Even acknowledging the need for kids' palliative care almost feels fatalistic. I'm wondering how parents and practitioners decide when to, quote, you know, give up treatment for a child.
Definitely. And I've spoken with a lot of providers about how difficult that conversation is to have, to the point that I think they have it in a really different way. I don't think that it is framed as like a, you know, as a giving up kind of conversation. I think that may be the kind of implied message, but they talk about it in a way of just, you know, how much can like a body take physically and how much can this family take emotionally of just pursuing curative treatment that doesn't work, right? Like pursuing a cure that isn't happening. And so I think they have those kind of conversations along the way. And I think that they also, and this I found to be really beautiful in the course of reporting it, I think that they speak with children a lot about what their needs are. And, you know, I had someone say to me, like, even at 6 years old, right, like a girl who's dying of cancer knows what she wants. And children in these situations are forced to grow up and they learn to articulate their needs. And I think in a lot of situations, you know, they're really able to communicate how pursuing a cure may not be the most important thing for them, that being with family and kind of enjoying the time that they have and the things that they want to do is really important. And it's definitely just a really difficult conversation to tackle. And I think that it leads to people pursuing treatments far longer than you might say the evidence would suggest they're working.
Yeah, it's astounding to think of. How about logistical issues that stand in the way of establishing more specialized end-of-life care for kids? I'm thinking funding, insurance coverage, maybe even religious or philosophical beliefs.
Definitely. I think that you have kind of a two-pronged issue, right? There is absolutely the logistical side of these things. So financially, all medical care is expensive, and end-of-life care is no different. So it's difficult to find ways to kind of support end-of-life care and families in that situation. I mean, I've heard about people who have gone bankrupt, right, trying to care for their sick child, and that's even before the child is facing like an end-of-life situation. That's why a lot of families actually end up on public insurance, even if they had private insurance to begin with. Their private insurance stops covering them while they're fighting these diseases that their children are facing, and so they end up having to turn to public insurance for assistance. And so there's definitely a financial burden that comes in these situations for families. Logistically, too, you see a lot of struggle with providers who do, many of them do go out and pursue these additional qualifications that will allow them to care for the particular needs of sick children, sick and dying children. But to do that, they need to go to just a handful of schools that provide these programs. One, for example, is Harvard, right? But not every doctor is located in the greater Boston area. So, you know, they need to apply to this program, take a year off from their job, go and live in Boston, pay the money for the program, and then return with those new skills. So it's a lot to ask. And I think that, you know, even before a doctor gets to that stage of figuring out if financially they can commit to it, there is that kind of emotional burden that comes with this particular issue that I think that we all struggle with, doctors included, where it's really hard to say, you know, that a child is going to die. Like, we've been told that children shouldn't die. And that means that we want to fight it. We want to find a cure. And I think that we all kind of have that mentality. So training and paying to learn how to give up in a sense, right, and how to give up gracefully and how to help others give up gracefully is not a thing that I think a lot of people want to pursue.
Eleanor Cummins is with us. She wrote about the logistical and ideological and emotional hurdles of pursuing end-of-life care, palliative or hospice care for children, for Slate. Specialized cancer care for children often is located in cities, not exclusively, but geography is a real issue for people. The best, the most advanced centers are generally in really populated areas. How would that kind of geography or location play a role in end-of-life planning for kids?
Right. So I am from Washington State. So we have the Seattle, like the greater Seattle area, which is highly urbanized. But the rest of the state is actually pretty rural and pretty divided. Like the Cascade Mountains go right down the middle, right? So, you know, it takes hours to get across them into Seattle. And so, you know, children who are in like the Okanagan Highlands, for example, may not have access to specialized pediatricians. So, you know, like they'll see their doctor for their checkups, but they aren't going to have a doctor who is trained in oncology or an expert in congenital disorders. And they're very unlikely to have a doctor who has gone to one of these specialized programs at a university to train in providing end-of-life care to children. So basically, they and their parents kind of have a choice to make where are they going to look to the resources that are close to them, which may not be, you know, substantial, or are they going to make a commitment to going back and forth across the state, potentially relocating to Seattle and living there, you know, with friends, family, short-term rental, the Ronald McDonald House, to try to get care. And that's a decision that a lot of people have to make. Even, you know, if their child eventually isn't one of the, you know, the children who dies and the child does get better and grow up, you know, they've lost tons of time, money, and resources in that process of trying to fight that disease just because of the kind of luck of the draw of location.
Eleanor, the UK came in first in the Economist Quality of Death Index. What is Great Britain doing that puts them on top? And is this with children's palliative and hospice care as well?
Right. So the UK is on top, I think, a lot because of history. They were kind of the they had the leaders in palliative care decades ago who were saying that, you know, there was a reason to put resources and time and thinking into how people died. And as a result, they've kind of generated this culture that really supports people in those last years and months of their life. And that, I think, is shown to be true for both adults and for children. In the UK, there's actually a system of palliative care homes for children. So if your child is suffering from one of these very like complex illnesses that may ultimately prove to be life-limiting, you know, they may die as children, there's an ability for you to go into a specialized care home. And these homes are very small. They're intimate. They're usually for, you know, eight families. And so a child and their parents and their siblings can go there and they can get treatment, but also counseling and support. And there's a real value placed on this idea of respite, that you can get kind of a break from pursuing your curative treatments and from the kind of, you know, hectic chaos that comes from being in a hospital and trying to get better. And so there's a lot more support and also kind of open conversation about how this is something that we all ultimately face, and a value placed on making death as easy as possible.
A moving story, and thank you very much for sharing it with us, Eleanor.
Definitely. Thank you for having me, Virginia.
Eleanor Cummins is a journalist who focuses on science, and you could find a link to read her piece for Slate, which is called American Children Deserve a Better Death. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And that story came to us from Nate DeMayo and the Memory Palace podcast. Thank you so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear and Broke for Free. You can find more on the show and listen to segments and share them with friends on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio or also on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And you can brush up on everything you slept through in civics class with our Civics 101 podcast.
The Chief of Staff organizes the rest of the White House. There are any number of White House offices, congressional liaison, counsel to the president, policymaking offices, there's the press office, the communications office, all that stuff has to be coordinated and managed. And it's something that presidents simply don't have time to do.
Just search Civics 101 on iTunes or Google Play or wherever the kids are getting their podcasts these days. And please rate it, because everything goes further when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow too, here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.